And today's guest on the show is Hector Christie. Hello, Hector.
Hello.
And I have to say, we actually come down to Devon to see Hector, where he lives, at a place called Tapley Park, which is a kind of ancestral home. And we are sitting here. Sometimes I wish we were on telly so people could actually see the sort of spectacular room we're in for doing this interview, basically. We're surrounded by portraits clearly dating from at least the 18th century, from my knowledge of art, and interesting portraits of Nelson and Napoleon, which I think I find quite interesting. But that's also interspersed with what we might call some slightly more modern pieces, with slogans on them like faceless multinationals and the love of money is the root of all evil. And I like that contrast, I really do. I think it's spectacular. So welcome to the show, Hector. Just to explain to the listeners, we first met in the summer when you're having a festival up here. And I came up with my ex-partner, Annie, and we had absolutely a fantastic weekend here, meeting many other people who are involved in getting the truth message out there or involved in the culture around that, playing music and so on. And we had an absolutely fabulous time here, as I say, so it's great to be back here again. And welcome, really, Hector. And could I just start off really by just asking a little bit about this place, about some of the history? Because I found that quite fascinating. Could you tell us a bit about the history?
Well, this place has basically been in my family for about just over 300 years. So obviously I don't want to be the one to make a mess of it, if I can possibly help it. And it basically dates back, there was a guy called Commodore William Cleveland, and he was sailing his very large ship up the estuary, apparently, looking up at the house through a telescope, and not where he was going. He went into a sandbank on the bar, which a lot of people had done. This area's got the largest number of shipwrecks in the world, stretching from here to Hartland. Shipwrecked his boat, but he wasn't too worried about that, for this would be the house for him. And so with the aid of a mortgage, he came up and he brought the place. And there's all sorts of things that went on. I mean, one of my most famous ancestors, for example, was Archibald Cleveland, who was one of three officers to survive the charge of the Light Brigade in the Crimean War. And after the charge, he was only 21, obviously part of the 17th Lancers, and He sent back a lock of his hair, a ring, and a letter to his mum. It was as if he knew he'd used his nine lives up, because he got like three bullets in him, one in his little tobacco breast pouch, which just in front of his heart. So anyone who tells you that smoking is dangerous, you better ask him about that. Another one went into his side, another one into his leg. In his letter that he sent back to his mum, he was incredibly scathing about Cardigan, because, I mean, his attitude was, there was all these £20 guns, you know, it's all very well for you, mate, sitting up there just trying to get your name in the history books. And the letter was very much along those sort of lines, but we're all going to get killed here. And they were convinced they were all going to get killed. So they bombed down, and obviously he was absolutely amazed, you know, when he got to the end, and he got to the lines of Prussians and things, and he went over and he described slashing a few of them, chopping a few of the heads off with his sword, which we still got in a little collection of swords out the back there. But he was actually then killed by a stray bullet at the Battle of Inkerman 10 days later. And that's why we got sort of monuments erected to him. There's two. There's one at the end of a field, and we've now opened that up to the public. So remember, the public can actually go there. It's about a mile and a half round trip. And you have the most fantastic views over the estuary of Instow and over to Lundy, which is our situation. And we've actually since built a labyrinth there, because in 1931, there was a phenomenal thunderstorm. And this obelisk had a 50-foot granite obelisk going up from it. And
tell us a little bit about the obelisk first, because I mean, obviously, we're always very interested in this kind of esoteric symbolism and so on. The obelisk, obviously, has a pyramid on top. It's said to be kind of male energy, obviously.
Yeah.
So how did that get to be put here in the first place?
Well, that was basically simply erected just to him. It's easy to get sidetracked, because I've had an awful lot of new agey types up here. I mean, in the early 90s, it was a full-on new age cult situation, as it were. And every single sort of like interesting spiritualist from here to Totnes and beyond actually seemed to move themselves in. We had everything from rebirthing, channeling, mediumship, tarot, healing, you name it. It was all going on up here at the time. And of course, they sort of like someone traced all the ley lines of that particular thing and found that this was like on a perfect ley line, sort of like a triangle somehow joining in with St. Michael's Mount, obviously, in near in South Cornwall, and Glastonbury going the other way.
I didn't realise that. So it actually forms some sort of triangle with the ley lines, is that right?
Yeah. Some sort of like trace or sort of like, right. You know, the ley lines down. I mean, what was interesting actually about that period is certainly it was this place is extremely intense. Tapley is a very, very intense energy. Before I got here, I was like farming over at Saunton. I had a few sheep and cattle and some pick your own strawberries and everything. And the beach was nearby, and I used to sort of like lie in bed. And the motto was pretty much surfs up, yields down, because as soon as any waves, we were all going surfing, obviously. And so actually, you know, I had a relatively cushy life. And at age 25, my aunt died. And it's sort of like, well, she'd had cancer for a while. And for some reason, you know, there was no members of my family sort of like down it except for me. So I thought, I'd better go and look after it. And I was right in the deep end because I had to kick a bloke out who she very nearly married. And he was like quite often sort of like used to beat my aunt up quite severely. And he was actually probably the only person I've ever met in my life who I was really, really scared of. And it took me 2 years to completely get rid of him. And I sort of chucked him out. And he was used to come back and literally was threatening to kill me, burn the place down. And the scariest thing of all was he was doing a lot of voodoo black magic on my aunt's grave. Now, this was before I actually understood about how the spiritual world works. And I was always extremely scared, having watched films like The Exorcist and all those terrifying films. So anything like that did actually scare me. What was interesting, you know, he sort of took me to court a couple of times, you know, for unfair dismissal, even though I never employed him and everything. And it was only after 2 years, and he was a big, burly bloke, that I actually pinned him to the wall. And I said, right, it's you and me to the death. And he saw it in my eyes. He jumped in this car, and I never saw him again. And of course, because at the end of the day, my aunt was a spinster. So, and those sort of people are cowards. And then sadly, a few years later, I heard he was doing exactly the same to some poor old lady down in Westwood Ho. Oh, but then when we had the New Age thing, you see, that sort of like started kicking in. There's like a phenomenal amount of poltergeist activity here. I mean, quite literally, I mean, lots of people used to see my great-grandmother in the house and things like that, and all these strange noises. But
was there any particular reason? Was there any strange deaths and things like that?
Yes. And that very much came out down in the barn, because the jousting, the British Jousting Association suddenly came down here, because I mean, at the end of the day, we're a sort of house and garden home to the public, and it was really not doing very well, and I was doing a terribly bad job at it because I was still farming over at Saunton at the time. So I didn't really want to be here. I hated it for the first few years. So anyway, this guy called Max Diamond, who's now sadly passed on, who claimed to be 68, he was still 68 about 10 years later, called himself the Black Gauntlet. And there's this whole host of like horses, knights in shining armor on the horseback. It's about like 8 horses and 20 footmen and things. And they all sort of like rocked up these huge great lorries. It was very exciting. And it was very good for the first couple of years. But the trouble is, we're not actually in the eastern counties, and people had to pay a bit more, and people don't have the money down in this area. And they simply didn't turn up. So he was like not making money. And so the horses gradually started dying, whatever, you know, bloody far. But at the same time, they used to do these medieval banquets in the barn. And he had this huge great Burton's dummy clad in all his protective armor and sword and helmet and everything. And all these shields and everything all the way around the wall. And this thing kept moving around the barn. And this got us quite curious. And we all thought someone else was moving it. So we all took turns in having the key. When it was my turn, I sort of like had the key. All the doors were locked. Put loads of talcum powder around it. And lots of little scratch marks within talcum powder within a 4-foot radius. So, and it needed 2 people to lift it up because there was a lot of armor on it. And I went back in the next day. And sure enough, you know, there was the Burton's dummy on the other side of the room. And I had the key. So I thought, I was hooked at that moment. And the interesting thing was on the beam, there was this name that appeared. It was like E. Shambrook and like Pyle. Well, no, sorry. It, and a little squiggle after it. Anyway, his wife's son was 15. And it turned out he was like the medium through which a lot of these entities actually worked at the time. And he looked at me, he was like doing a mirror image on the floor. And he suddenly, what's this squiggle? That intrigued us. And he suddenly realized, I said, that's Pi R squared. He was obviously going to school. So he went up into the flat, which is a part of this house, and he got his calculator out, tapped in pi r squared, and if you turn it upside down, you get hello boy, which always happens. He then tapped it in again, and basically then a 7-figure number came up, And he just said, that's a telephone number. And he went off to a telephone book. And I said, look, I'm sorry. I'm not going to sit around here all night while you go through the telephone book looking for this wretched number. He said, no. And he opened up, he literally went, boom. He said, no. And he shut it again. He went, boom, again. And this he saw this seven-figure number. And it was right next to the name of E. Shambrook. And it was in, like, bold black print. And it really stood out. And the interesting thing was, the next day when I opened up the same telephone book, it was the same sort of like as the rest of the numbers and names around it. It's sort of like gone back. But obviously, I was meant to see that.
Yeah.
And that completely sort of like thought, my God, I want to get to the bottom of this, because I've been brought up. I've thrown through a very conventional upbringing, and I went to Eton, which I didn't particularly like at all. And I got by because I was playing football all the time. And
similar sort of journey to me in terms of being a sort of a rationalist and going through a traditional education system in which you're encouraged to approach problems in a rational way and use the rational side of the brain and not really appreciate any of the more kind of spiritual or ethereal things, basically.
No, because very much what I found is I go off to church, and okay, it gave you sort of like a nice moral foundation, but absolutely no faith whatsoever.
Yeah.
I'm afraid, I think
it's optional in the Church of England, isn't it?
I think that's a lot of people's experience of Christianity. So suddenly, when I was faced with this, I suddenly thought, my God, there is something else. There is potentially life after death. So I got ridiculously overexcited at that moment and wanted to know more. And anyway, so he would sit there, and we ended up, he was a medium who was like channeling these entities. And he came up with stories of like some of the murders that had actually happened up here in the sort of like the mid to late 1800s, particularly in the kitchen area, which is around the barn area. And it turns out when he checked out the library, the names did actually check, which is extremely fascinating.
Oh, really?
And he was dyslexic, and it was extraordinary watching him do it, because he'd sit there with his eyes closed, you know, literally sort of like one hand over his eyes, and he'd be writing. And he wrote this perfect, beautiful Victorian ink, you know, handwriting. And what was interesting was like when sometimes that, you know, we were sort of asking questions, me and his mum, and if we took a little bit of time to sort of like answer the questions, then basically he would the pen would just fly out of his hand across the room, because the entity was sort of like getting a bit of a bait. Honestly, it was just quite a weird thing to happen. And so that got me hooked in. And then, but the trouble was though, at that period, I actually then ended up getting taken over by an entity. Now, I don't know if you, David, you might not. Have you been taken over by an entity?
I don't know,
disincarnate?
I've certainly had problems that I had. In fact, actually, when I was at the Big Green Gathering, somebody did some kind of treatment for me. And I was actually, got to say, to be honest, actually quite cynical about this. And some guy, you know, dangling some crystal in front of me and calling on the archangels and all this sort of stuff. And I thought, yeah, it sounds like a bollocks, quite frankly. And at the end of it, he said, you've had these two entities squatting, and they've been squatting between your, kind of in a space between your ears. And it was really quite funny, because I have had problems around the back of my neck and my ears. So suddenly I thought, obviously I'm being too cynical here. I should really open myself up to this stuff. And he said there had been, and they'd been let in at a time when I had some trauma in MI5, and I had actually at one point fallen downstairs when I was drunk and broken my ankle. And clearly these sort of entities were with me for a long time in my life. And once they got rid of them, they say it was only early this summer, my life did actually change quite a lot.
Right, yes.
Yeah, so I've had experience of this kind of thing. So.
But this thing, it was like it actually became into me. And the thing is, though, if you've got sort of disincarnate in you, of course they don't need to eat or drink. So I suddenly found myself like hardly eating or drinking anything. And the thing is, after about sort of 3 days, and I was still farming, and it was during the 1990 World Cup, and I'm absolutely passionate about football, as I know you are, and it was leading up to the England-Holland game. Big game in the qualifiers. I think we won 2-0 that particular
I think it was Middle East, wasn't it? The qualifiers.
No, this is in the group stage. This is in the group stage of the 1990 World Cup.
Yeah, we drew Middle East, Holland.
No, we beat Holland. We definitely beat Holland. But the point was, I remember sort of trying to drive over there, and I kept turning back and going back to the barn. I kept getting bored, and I thought, this is not right. So anyway, I did my own individual form of exorcism. I got 20 cans of Red Strike, organised a party after the game. Of course, England won 2-0 or 3-0, whatever it was. Suddenly we realised England could play, and of course they weren't at the semi-final. And I basically shouted a lot and had a fantastic party and drank all the 20 cans and probably quite a bit more. And I was fine the next day. But the problem was, though, was this guy's mum was not so lucky, because she didn't drink properly. And she didn't get exercised. And she basically hardly ate or drank anything for 3 months. And she was going down the pan. It looked like she was, because she also got taken over. Because, of course, we didn't have a clue what we were doing. And that's why it's incredibly important not to mess with that sort of thing unless you actually really, really know what you're doing. And it's, and then I think it got out. It got out in the papers. It got out in the sort of like the local North Devon Journal. And it got picked up by a guy called Graham Wiley, who had a weekly article in the Sun at the time, centre page, all about ghost stories. He heard about us, and he wanted to come down because obviously someone sent this clip. So he came down. He wanted to spend a night in the barn. And I thought, oh God, it's probably going to have a boring night and everything. I was very, you know, very. Anyway, we went in there. I wasn't actually there. We went in with thought like Max Diamond, alias the Black Gauntlet, Joan, Peter, and set up his bed and things like that. And they were sitting there, and suddenly that dummy, that was the Burton's dummy, who was literally had a sword in front of him, according to Max Diamond as well, who just like was not into any of this, lifted up his sword three times, boom, boom, boom. Max said, sod this, I'm out of here. And he was off, you know. Anyway, obviously Graham Wiley thought, right, we're in for a good night. So you got him to sort of like, you know, he got us to lock him in, basically, so he can escape. Everyone else went to bed. And he said, it was fascinating, like, because all the shields and things were being swapped around the wall. But he said the most extraordinary thing that happened, when he very slightly dimmed the lights, he wanted to change the film on his camera. His bed was next to a sort of like big set of double doors, and there was a huge, great aluminium ladder. And you know what it's like if you just touch an aluminium ladder, it rattles. And anyway, he sort of like put the lights back up a little bit, and because everything's marked where it was, so he couldn't make any mistakes. And suddenly, a mood, that changed. He suddenly realised that an aluminium ladder had gone. And what had happened is it sort of like reappeared the other side of the barn. And of course, what happens in those sort of situations is obviously, basically, it's just like out of Star Trek. You know, it dematerializes and then rematerializes like elsewhere. So as far as he was concerned, he had a fantastic evening. But he was terribly worried about this guy's mum. But he knew this person lived down in Totnes called Dougie, and who was a healer and a spiritualist and everything like that. And he said, and also an exorcist. And we'd had like a couple of like basically the Protestant church wouldn't touch it with a barge pole. We'd had a couple of Catholic priests who came up who were completely freaked out. They didn't want anything to do with the place, you know, because it was Poltergeist Central. And there was nails flying across the room, the barn and things like that.
So this is like something out of the film Poltergeist, isn't it? It really is.
It really was. And it was getting a little bit out of hand. So anyway, but luckily Dougie, as he was called, he exorcised Joan. And sort of like got the entity out. But the problem was with him, you know, he was like a little bit sort of like on a bit of an ego trip. And to be honest, actually, I do find that in this sort of new age spiritual thing, there's more ego than basically any other thing. There's the real small amount of gems, but there's a phenomenal amount of ego.
Well, this is what puts a lot of people off the kind of new age stuff. I mean, certainly my own experience, I was put off by these people who, again, have enormous egos and seem to do very little, basically. And, of course, that is the complete opposite of a true spiritual person, of course, who denies ego and puts other people before themselves. And I suppose that kind of stuff is promoted for that very deliberate reason, I think, to stop people from being interested in this kind of stuff, really.
Yeah.
I don't think these things happen by accident.
No, definitely not. But he was saying it was quite when he arrived, he said it's like his path was like a mile wide and he was like walking down the centre of it. Literally, they were being about a week up here. And he was like walking on a knife edge. And, of course, he was actually then... And he was very interested in taking control over the place. And sort of like by that, it was like me. And obviously I was quite hooked in. I mean, I saw some extraordinary things. Like for example, there's this granary area, which is just next to our public toilets. And it's got an amazing energy in it. Incredible sort of like, you know about that. And we were sitting in there one day and sort of like a jouster. And the jouster came, he's like, had a bad back for like a couple of years, hadn't been at a ride. And said, look, you know, he'd heard that, you know, Dougie was a healer. And so he came up and Dougie sort of stood back and said, okay, I think we'll let them do this. You know, because he got a message to sort of like, and he's literally sat back in his chair, and this guy was sitting in the middle of the room, and I actually saw it. His the back of his jumper was going up and down, just like flickering in and out, and he said, "God, this feels really weird." And sort of like I said, "Yeah," I said, "it looks like someone's opened a can of worms, just poured it down the back of your jumper," and he said, "Yeah, it feels really strange." And they said, "All right, you know," and after sort of a few minutes, it stopped, and all the rest of it. After that, his back was completely better, and the next day he was back on a horse. So when you see things like that for yourself, and I would never expect people to believe. I'm a complete advocate for sort of like having proof.
Yeah. I think check these things out for
yourself. Check things out, unless you know. And I think you know if you want to sort of like believe something, blind faith. I think is somewhere where Christianity, especially, has gone. You know, incredibly wrong. There's no excuse for blind faith. You know, there's nothing wrong with asking for proof. And I believe if you ask for proof and you're meant to have it, you will get it from the spirit world. So, but the thing is, I obviously was like hooked, And I did spend a couple of years fluttering around with the birdies, because obviously suddenly discovering that there is life after death is extremely exciting, having always believed actually in absolutely nothing whatsoever. Suddenly you are sort of rather blown away. And I think that happened a lot at those times, because I mean, I do really believe that the start of the Aquarian age actually happened around about 1989, 1990. There's new energy starting to come into the planet. Of course, that was when Ike went off his bike. And the thing is, as we all know, I mean David Icke...
He almost seemed to get it before everybody else, didn't he? And as a result of that, he didn't seem to quite know how to handle it. And perhaps
he
now,
didn't quite handle it.
Back at it, he probably wouldn't do it in the same way, I don't think.
Of course he wouldn't. No, of course he wouldn't. And then he was going around sort of like wearing turquoise and calling himself the Son of God and things like that. And of course, you know, things could have been slightly distorted. But, you know, he behaved in a certain way that the authorities don't really have to worry too much about him in their minds, because exactly, he's ridiculed enough, which is really what they, you know, want to do with the rest of us. It's very much a similar sort of principle. You're ridiculed enough and everything like that, and then you sort of basically, there's a few people that are going to listen to them. And sadly, David likes that bracket, because I think he actually comes out with a lot of very good stuff. I mean, that book... what's it called? Not in the light of truth, but The Truth Will Set You Free.
Yeah, that's a great one.
You know, there's some great stuff in that. The Oklahoma Bombs and all that stuff, you know. I mean, you know. But anyway, it was that sort of time that all this sort of things was going on. And then, of course, there was someone else who came up, a girl who sort of like took over and managed to oust the current, the other guys, Dougie and his like entourage, were booted out. And she was like... she was in a way far more dangerous, because she used the sort of like the female goddess sexual energy and things to sort of particularly sort of like get all the men around here and things. And
it's quite interesting, doesn't it? I thought that
involved, you know, and you know, so we didn't quite go to the group orgy phase, you know. But actually, talking to me, the rumours flying around about me at the stage were. You know, yeah, the rumors were quite extraordinary, because it was lots of sort of like bunny boiling and sort of like biting chicken heads off. My favorite one was I was in the graveyard in Westley Church, making love to virgins on the top of the gravestones. Of course,
if only.
Got that good.
Where'd you get the supply of virgins from? That's what
particularly around Biddeford, Barnsfield.
But can we just come back to this obelisk?
Yeah,
fascinated by that. Almost that puts a lot of it into context about the different energies around here. And for any of our listeners who might be cynical about things like ladders moving and so on, appear to have been teleported, like in Star Trek. I mean, they have actually teleported electrons now. Our understanding of quantum mechanics is these things can happen in the quantum universe. The Newtonian universe isn't the be-all and end-all of everything, clearly. And it only operates in our dimensions. Once you start to study things at submolecular level, you realize that electrons can disappear and appear elsewhere. And this is perfectly normal for the quantum world. It's just, we don't normally understand how that world works. It works at such a microscopic level. But the thing that fascinated me, I say, was this obelisk. Because you say this is the ley lines around here. There's also I find in Devon generally there's a very female energy, say, compared to London, where it's one of the theories in London about why they actually built the dome was to try and balance Canary Wharf, which of course is a fucking great big obelisk, basically.
Yeah.
So it created this turbulent masculine energy in London, and that's why they needed the dome. And in some ways, that's the only thing that makes sense around the dome. Why would you build this bloody great big white elephant, stock it full of nonsense, expect people to go and see it out in Greenwich, and then have it empty for ages? What function does it really have? The function it really has is to balance that bloody great big obelisk.
Yeah.
And there is a say of the female energy here, but we were saying that there was this obelisk here, and we'll please tell the listeners what happened to it. This is fascinating.
Well, I was about to say that actually, but in 1931 it got struck with hit by a thunderbolt, and local sort of people, according to the North Devon Journal at the time, saw lumps of this granite flying 100 yards up into the air, and I just thought, you know, like, and all the rest of it. And that stone was all, you know, stacked around the side of the obelisk. And I spoke to a guy called Charlie Gorvin, who started work here in 1920, and he died in 1999, and about 6 months before. I actually just liked chance. I just was up seeing him, and I asked him about this. And he said, well, actually, we heard this almighty explosion. And we actually went down. We realised it was over at the obelisk, and we literally found lumps of granite 300 yards away in the woods below. And they basically used that and they stacked it up. And anyway, by this stage, we were sort of like I was to cut long, you know, it's a long story short, I had to leave Tapley for 3.5 years because I left my wife and children, not for anybody else, but I just, marriage wasn't working. And I was, you know, everyone wanted to boot them out, but of course I wasn't going to. So I was in a tiny little cottage. That's why I wrote a book, and then all about the new agey stuff, because I'd come out the other side, called No Blade of Grass, which explains why the good things happen and the apparently not so good.
Yeah, I've got to say, I read Hector's book and I found it very, very concise and very, very easy to read. Very, very good sort of guide to spirituality for anybody who's, you know, even slightly interested in these things. It's one of those books that doesn't bamboozle you with New Age jargon and stuff like that. I thought it came very much from the heart, and I'd recommend the book to anybody. Yeah.
Oh, that's, you know, I tried to write it quite objectively, and it took me 3 years to write. When I did, of course, I did that when I was outside, and I was doing healing at the time and everything else. But then, sort of like, to come back to the obelisk, and then I came back here in about 1998. And what was quite interesting then was I was going through a sort of like rather difficult divorce and things. It's never going to happen. So I think I left her in 1994, and it sort of like dragged on and on and on. And my ex schizophrenic sister-in-law rang me up and said, could you come down and stay for 3 weeks? And she had nowhere else to go at this particular time. So she came down and she ended up staying for 3 years. But I moved back in, and basically it was just me and her rattling around in this big old house. And after about a couple of years, it was actually getting really, really depressing. It felt like being in a prison. I couldn't leave her on her own here or anything like that. And again, really typical, intense Tapley energy trying to propel me into a different direction. But I didn't know what it was, and it wasn't the right time, and bloody blah. And suddenly there's some friends of mine started moving up here a little bit. And then I thought, well, hang on a minute, this is the way to go. And out of the blue, there was some guy, sort of like called Mark Barrett from Spain, who contacted me. He heard there was one or two people up here, and he was an incredibly charismatic, very good-looking guy, and he knew it as well. And he sort of like came up, and we sort of like chatted away. And he was had an American wife at the time. And within literally a few weeks, this house was absolutely chock-a-block with people, because he knew everybody. And it was then, it was the start of like community living as it is at the moment. And of course, you know, I'll just jump to go back to the obelisk, otherwise I get sidetracked. And we were talking about, you know, he said, we must have a labyrinth. All these sort of places should have a labyrinth. It's vital we have a labyrinth. Where could we build it? And they had all these different ideas and things like that. And it's sort of like cutting out from some of the Christmas trees we got around the back. And then one day I was sitting up on the obelisk, funny enough, and I was like looking out to sea, and I had one of these like eureka moments. So I was sitting up there and I sort of, you know, meditating, you know, and I, you know, I was like still meditating once a day back then. Sadly, I don't know, do nearly enough of it now, which annoys me. I must get back to that. And I was sitting there, and I suddenly thought, boom, do the labyrinth here with all the sort of like the granite, which had basically been picked up from out of the wood, and was all lying around the obelisk, and just basically make a labyrinth. At that moment, it was the most extraordinary thing, because the clouds parted. It was an overcast day. This extraordinary red light came out from the sky, lit the whole estuary up in front, blood red, literally blood red, all the way down to sort of like the confluence of the River Tor and Torridge, you know, going out to sea on the bar. And I sort of like, they went running back to, you know, all the hippies, you know, and they were hippies, like here at the time, and managed to sort of like get through some of the smoke that they were smoking and just say, look, you know, we're going to do the labyrinth up by the obelisk. And they, all of them unanimously went, yes, it makes sense. And what was interesting then was like, okay, let's do it. And we decided to do the classical seven ring design, which is like the oldest design of labyrinth. And it basically sort of like, the difference between a labyrinth and a maze. In a maze, you have sort of like, you know, stop off points and things like that. And I'm sure you know, but a labyrinth is basically like a journey. And the classical seven ring design, it was designed right about the times of Perseus and things. And you go basically sort of like, you know, you sort of like go on a set route, and it's like a passage through life, because you go sort of go around and you just like follow the stones around, and you find yourself, you think you're getting somewhere, and then suddenly you find yourself going further and further away from the center, the object. And in the center we had this the top of the obelisk, which was like this perfect sort of like pyramidal shaped top. And you suddenly, you know, you think, oh my God, and suddenly then, you know, you're right on the outside of it. You think, oh God, I'm getting nowhere. It's typically symbolic of life. And then suddenly you sort of like, you know, you keep going. And suddenly then, boom, the center starts appearing again. You think, oh, thank goodness for that. And just when you think you're about to get there, you start going back out again. And the whole key to it is, and of course, what we're so tempted to do in life, and this is the symbolism of this, that we're actually sort of making progress, and then you don't get anywhere. And instead of actually keeping going, you start backtracking. And of course, that's where it goes pear-shaped. The secret is to keep going through all these negative experiences and keep going forwards, never going backwards.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's the symbolism. That's why I think it's such a beautiful design. And it's so easy to set up. And anyway, we sort of literally set it up with string and things like that. Me and the guy called Richard, who was here, very, very nice bloke, actually. And what was interesting is then everyone else got involved in it. Everyone was into the labyrinth. And they all started measuring it up. And this American girl said, Hector, you're not going to have nearly enough granite to do this labyrinth and bloody blah and all the rest of it. You know, because she was thinking we were going to stick it all together, and I wasn't particularly thinking that. And then it suddenly started getting all dark, and everyone was looking around other bits of the ground to find other bits of stone that could go into it. And I just suddenly just said, just shut up, all of you. Just shut up. I'm just going to go and build it, you know. Forget it. And anyway, so I went out there. So me and Richard, no one else, said, oh, you do it then, you know, because everyone was like, oh, I get, you know. So I went out there and sort of marked it out with sort of like the bits of string. Literally took 20 minutes. And then other people started getting involved. We started, you know, lugging this stuff, you know, because these are heavy old bits of granite, you know, and lugging it around. We found the best way actually was the magic carpet, sort of like, you know, these great big belts you put around you, and sort of like you just roll it onto a sort of like a carpet and then just like, you know, drag it on. Anyway, so doing it like that, and there was 372 bits of granite in all. And the extraordinary thing was, we just literally built it, and we had exactly the right amount of granite. Not one bit too many, not one bit too few. We didn't need any more. We had precisely the right amount, which shows as meant to be.
Absolutely.
And again, that symbolised the whole meaning of that classical seven-ring design. And of course, then we had sort of fantastic far-walking ceremonies to open it and things like that, which is another story, isn't it? But we've had it all over here.
No, I think that whole story about it, I mean, I've obviously heard that full version, which is, it makes it even more fascinating. It really does. I mean, just the basic story that they put an obelisk here and it got disintegrated. I think it's very interesting to say because of the kind of female energies around here. And I mean, even some of the names I find quite strange. I mean, the River X, the X in Hebrew is Zadek, and means righteousness.
Right.
Dart comes up, which of course is the to Kabbalah is the 11th Sephirot, means knowledge, the one that's not connected to the tree of life. And of course, this area of the world, I mean, Cornwall, not so much actually Devon itself, but Cornwall and Somerset are all associated with the young Jesus coming here with Joseph of Arimathea and all
that's
these
right,
ancient
yeah.
myths around the tin industry and so on. So this part of the world, I mean, yeah, and Glastonbury as well, but it is this part of the world as well as Glastonbury, I think, is redolent with all this stuff. You know, when I talk about the conflict that's going on at the moment. I mean, I'm a bit like you. I mean, I was very much in the kind of rationalist sort of mindset. But now I believe these things. I my conversion came because of the Bible code or the Torah code or whatever. And I do believe that what was predicted in terms of the end of days is what we're living through now, the battle of good and evil.
Yeah.
And you know, we're seeing it in particularly in this country. I think the fact we have so many stone circles here and the fact that something like 85% of the crop circles that occur in the world occur in southern England, in fact, in the old county of Wessex, is telling us that this is the battleground between good and evil.
Yeah.
Because in a sense, you know, the rest of the world's already gone one way, America's going another way, and we're in between.
Yes.
And it's that sense, I think, that's why the battleground will be here, in terms of the battle for kind of hearts and minds and so on. Could you just talk a little bit more? Because I mean, obviously, I'm just trying to get the sort of chronology here, the sort of spiritual conversion. So, I mean, you came to live here, you know, you say just as a kind of rationalist and saw all this stuff, and then sort of how did you sort of change your way of life? I mean, was there any particular one thing in these poltergeist things, or was it just an accumulation of stuff where you just thought I can no longer be a rationalist? There's just too much information that shows me the Newtonian universe isn't the be all and end all.
Oh, I very quickly sort of like stopped being a rationalist. And then, of course, I actually had the experience of going completely the other way. You know, as I said, I was flapping around up there with the birdies for a couple of years. And that really was the catalyst to the end of my marriage. I mean, that it would have ended anyway, because when I got married, you know, I didn't actually have a clue what marriage is about, like a lot of young people don't. And, you know, I was like talking about all these, you know, ethereal sort of like claptrap, really. I can be, you know, frank about it at the time to my poor wife, who was like a full-on rationist. And as we were talking about a bit earlier, you know, when, you know, the trouble is, you know, if you're with a partner and one decides, one actually goes on a spiritual journey and the other doesn't, you know, I don't think there's not much hope in that relationship. Sadly, it does seem to be like that.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I'm kind of going through at the moment. Certainly, it really is.
Yeah. You know,
desperately trying to, well, what can I say? I mean, I'm, you know, and the funny thing about it is, as well, it helps you cope with all these things. This is the funny thing about it, is that, you know, people say, well, how do you cope with these things? And I said, well, I am truly a spiritual person, so that's one of the ways you do cope with these things.
Yeah.
You can make back to your story. You're saying, so you obviously, Jimmy, then left your wife. And what sort of year are we talking about? When was that?
1994.
Actually, the divorce was it 98 or something?
Yeah, ended up sort of like 1998, and it was quite weird actually, because during this, just before, it was in 1994. I was like talking to this friend of mine, and I just literally came out with this thing that came into my head, and it just came out immediately, like these things do. And 1994, open up the door. 1995, try to stay alive. 1996. Pick up the sticks. 1997, start to move to heaven. 1998, stand up true and straight. 1999, align with the divine, you know. And actually, in a way, that's exactly the way my life went. It just came to me just like that, like those sort of things do. In a way, I think that you can slightly put this to sort of like 2000, you could do the same thing, but more on a global scale. And I think, you know, sort of like you think 2009, there's so much, you know, prediction with stuff like ID cards, GM food coming in, you know, horrendous things coming in 2009. But you get the yin and the yang, and maybe that's the prelude to lead up to 2012. Who knows? We would like to think it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, well, without a shadow of a doubt, the world is changing. There's been more and more people are going on this kind of spiritual path. I mean, obviously, I'm new to it, but I've talked to people who've been going to festivals the last 20 years, and they're actually quite amazed by... on the one hand, you know, the amount of people that are obviously coming to festivals, but in a different way now. I mean, you know, in the mainstream, many more people now are sort of taking the spiritual path and really realizing that you don't have to be part of the rat race and so on. It's really the quality of your life. And what capitalism wants off you is basically a good 8 or 9 hours of your day, 5 days a week. And as far as I'm concerned, nobody can pay me enough money to compensate for that. You know, it's just really not good enough.
It's interesting you say that, because I just went up to the climate change demo last weekend. And I really thought about it yesterday. I wish I'd actually taken up in a banner which just said, the hippies were right. Because I was so angry. I think it came to me like yesterday. That's it. But anyway.
So yeah, perhaps we could talk a bit as well about your campaigning work. So I know obviously you've done a lot of work against GM food and against foot and mouth. And one thing I just want, please, I mean, let's talk about the story where you managed to heckle Blair at the Labour Party conference, because that to me sounds great. And that's the kind of thing we need to be doing, being in their faces and so on. You know, as far as I'm concerned, the modern political system doesn't work. They've got it sewn up. They own the politicians. They own the media and so on. So we have to resort to things that obviously aren't violence, but are a very effective way of being in their face. And I think this is an absolutely excellent example of that. I really do.
Well, do you think maybe we should go back to, because like, you know, the whole campaigning thing was started in sort of like 2001. First of all, because that happened in 2004,
right? Okay,
and that came very much as sort of like as a culmination of like the campaigning that started then. And I'm like yourself, if something's meant to happen and things happen at the right time. My biggest problem in life is like that frustration, that lack of patience, is wanting things to change now, immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And that's my biggest downfall, but at the same time, that's my biggest motivator, because it makes me very determined to sort of like carry on. But basically, sort of like the way the world was going, and at that particular time, and funnily enough, sort of like towards the end of 2000, I chucked all this initial group of hippies out. Because basically, I found myself doing all the cooking, the cleaning, and the shopping. And meanwhile, sort of like these hippies were sitting around in the kitchen smoking copious amounts of pot, you know, and just doing a few hours a week, you know, sort of justify, you know, sort of like being here and everything. That was the deal. That's the way it works. And I remember sort of like one day, they'd been here for about a year. And I sort of came in lame with sort of like, you know, bags, you know, from the local shop and things like that. And sort of like putting it on the table. And this American girl started going through the through all the bags. And she said, suddenly says, you know, none of them got out to help me, obviously, like they never did. And she said, Hector, you've forgotten to get my vegetarian quorum sausages. And honestly, I found myself turning to go out of the door to go down to the frigging shop to get her frigging bloody vegetarian corn sausage. And I got to the door and I said, what am I doing? And I turned around and I said, there are a lot of you. Fuck off! Like that. And I had them all out within about 2 weeks. You know? And it was like... And the thing is, though, the fascinating thing about sort of like community living is there's no way you can actually read a book about it and say this is how it should be. Every single community situation has its own unique way, and every circumstance is different. You have to work it out for yourself.
Yeah.
And the only way you work it out for yourself is by learning by your mistakes, is actually trying something, okay, boom, that doesn't work, wallop, you know, and then you're on to the next. And I've had a series of sort of like phases ever since. And we, you know, just sort of like cut to the quick, you've had a massive one this year, because I've suddenly, it was worst case scenario this summer when you were down, David. And I, you know, at the time people were stealing stuff, not just from the place, out of my bedroom, going in, and also just taking really personal things, you know, belonging to me. And then sort of like, you know, when I did actually chuck them out, then there was like massive loads of vandalism that was gone directed to me and Linton, who sort of like helps manage the place, you know. I mean, like, you know, my Massey Ferguson, which is like when I first started farming in 1986, I keep my dear old Massey Ferguson going. And I was like making hay, and, you know, making hay as a farmer, which is basically what I am, is a critical thing, you know, and basically the starter smitch was smashed to pieces and things like that, you know, it's absolutely gutting me. But luckily I got a mate, so I borrowed his tractor. And my pig pen was kicked in, where I keep the pigs are everywhere. And this guy, Linton, basically, the worst thing is they did that, actually smashed off a padlock, because he has some rescue birds in the RSPCA. They smashed a padlock off with a sledgehammer, and that bird was like being nurtured back to health. Of course, it got out and died, and he was devastated. And then, you know, in a way, the worst one of all was like, we got our own solar water panels, because we're going to try and be grid free by 2008. We built our own things, and these guys wanted to sort of like do it themselves. And they were talking about it for 2 years, and they'd done nothing, you know, it's typical sort of fluffy nonsense. And basically, they got to smash the sort of like the ball cock valve on the top, or the pipe, whatever, and there was water spurting out. And all over the sort of like the floor of the toilets, had someone gone in to sort of like the women's public toilets and actually, whether it be a men of public or someone here, turned that light on, that was life. They could have died, water on the floor. So, I mean, you know, serious stuff. And people, the great thing was, it was the bottoming out. So now we've got the most fantastic bunch of people. Now, I'm saying that every community should have to go through that. But I think because of the situation we're in, and like just to sort of like just briefly touch base on what everyone was saying in the early 90s in our sort of like new agey phase. Yeah. Everyone kept going on this place about being an island of light. There's going to be a few islands of light that are going to be shining as beacons and examples of how we should live. And we all confuse that. Like a lot of new agey think island of light is bliss out zone. You just put your hand out, you just like sit back and enjoy it. What they forget is light is incredibly bright and it actually shows up all your weaknesses, you know. And we've had a lot of people up here who haven't lasted very long, but suddenly, you know, as I said, their paths go incredibly narrow and they're out here. They just get out. They can't handle it because it is like that. It calls a spade. It's very, very black and white. And it's just the energy of the place. It's where it is. And that's why we, all of us here, I say, you've got to get away from it sometimes, just to simply get away from it, because it is an intense energy. And that's why the experiences up here are intense. And of course, you know, no more intense than, you know, when it started off, you know, the whole foot and mouth thing kicked off. And that sort of like then took us onto this new sort of like phase up there. Because I was like, you know, being a semi-professional footballer, sort of like for all my sort of like adult life, really, for like years and years and years. I mean, you know, pay 50 or 60 quid a game or something like that. But, you know, I always just tell the children that, put the food on the table, because that's the only way I could get them to come and watch, especially my daughter, poor thing. So I couldn't think what else to do at the time when I had her up here. And anyway, I was like sort of playing for Biddeford at the time. And what's interesting is like early 2001, we had a game in the FA Cup, I think it was, against Poulton Rovers up in Bristol. And the day before, there was this is like the year after I kicked all the hippies out, there was this like one guy living up here, he's like just came in to start, that guy called Nick Skinner. I mean, really, you know, top bloke, big beefy guy. And I suddenly said, I've got to show you how to feed the animals. So I took him around and showed him all the feed the animals, the Highland cattle, the pigs, the chickens, the whatever else, the dog, obviously. And anyway, he said, and I was writing all day. So you don't have to do that. I said, don't ask me why. I've got to do it. So next day, and I was on 13 goals, actually, and I was a little bit uneasy about being on 13 goals for some reason, even though I actually think 13 is very good now. I think death is an excellent thing, and it actually proved in this case, and I knew it, it was. And I was through on the keeper, one-on-one, and suddenly, sort of like, on the left-hand side, I saw this like great big 16-stone defender, and I just knew, I saw him coming in two-footed, and I knew that I was gonna be snapped in two. And I looked down, and I literally saw my left leg bend like an EU banana. He actually put his foot through my leg. And I just sat on the ground quietly. And they always say, when footballers, when they're writhing around in agony, things like, they're fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's when the player just sits there quietly, that is when there is a serious injury. And I just told the goalkeeper very kindly, and my first thought was, that was why I showed Nick how to feed the animals. And I immediately went into a different headspace. I was totally acceptance. It's the thing of being in the moment.
Yeah.
And like for years of sort of like doing meditation, all this stuff with these new age things, I never, ever, ever, ever managed that completely. And I was in the moment. It's like my past is irrelevant. And suddenly the future was a blank canvas. And I told the goalkeeper, I said, look, I've broken my leg. Can you just get a stretcher on as quickly as possible before the pain kicks in, get an ambulance and bloody burn all the rest of it? I went into the hospital, said I had double tib break, shattered above and below, and he literally put my tib into the calf muscle, and I was told I might never walk again. And I completely accepted it. I completely accepted it. And I was in the corridor for the first night, and a lot of people be in hospital, and that's sad. It was not, bloody privatisation, as we know, it's another story. And anyway, so I was sort of like lying there, and I had 3 days and three nights, and in Forest Green Ward, I think, in Bath, and the most fantastic sort of like hospital. And it just so happened the top pin specialist in the country was at work that weekend at the time. And the main striker before me at Biddeford had had exactly the same break. He went to Western Supermare, and he's in a wheelchair for the rest of his life, got an infection and things, and they told me this, and the guy did. I went for that rather than plaster Paris. He did a 5-hour operation, lined up, somehow managed to sort of like without opening up the thing. Goodness knows how he did it. I still got the pin in it now, and I'm just incredibly fortunate. I still play a bit for a bit of a reserves to help me out the youngsters and things like that now. But it was like it was that incredible spiritual awakening, and I just knew, and I kept lying in bed thanking God for directly intervening. Taking the trouble to directly intervene in my life, because I knew my life was going to go off in a different direction. No idea what it was going to be, but I didn't need to because I shown my friend, and that was enough evidence I had. And then of course I came back here and was like terrified of all these wooden stairs and things on the crutches. I think I had 3.5 weeks of R&R, and I had a classic Saul on the Road to Damascus type experience because I was sitting there watching the telly. And at lunchtime, and suddenly the foot and mouth are kicked in, obviously, sort of like early February, and they're still on the news, it's starting to spread up towards North Devon. And it was just like, bing, that was it. And I just thought, my God, but what do I do? Literally half an hour later, a bloke I met once in my life just turned up out of the blue, knocked on the door, and he said, so I don't know why, Hector, I've only met you for 5 minutes, and I had no idea who he was. He said, I've downloaded all this information about vaccination off the internet for you, vaccination of foot and mouth, don't know why, and he gave it to me, and that was it. I grabbed it, and I was in Hoover mode. I just like learned every single thing about vaccination and every single thing about EU law, and I was just like armed myself up to the eye teeth with knowledge, which turned to be the absolute key in that whole foot and mouth thing.
Now, I was going to say a point, because it's a very good point, but just stop you there, is that what you're saying earlier on about this whole blind faith thing, is it's all the nonsense. Blind faith is what leads to the Spanish Inquisition, is what leads to Nazism. The spirituality is not about being all kind of airy-fairy about things. It's actually about using things like knowledge and so on, but sometimes just being led to that knowledge at the right time and the right moment, basically.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the knowledge is important, but you get led to it more easily, I think, if you're open to the light and so on, as you're talking about this experience, basically.
Yeah, you have to be. I think that most people get led to it, but it's just a question of whether they actually realise it or not.
I think
we all do on our own individual experiences.
Yeah.
Because I don't think anyone's any more special than another. Obviously, and I certainly don't think I am.
No, I think that's anybody goes through that experience. Normally, I think it seems to happen in your late 30s, around about sort of age 37, 38, it seems to happen, which of course traditionally we've seen in the West as a kind of midlife crisis.
Mm.
But this is not just traditional to Western culture. It's actually in all cultures there is this
right.
kind of change that goes on in your late 30s, and it's really How you react to that change is how you live the rest of your life. And really, the choice is really whether you become a spiritual person and try to look after other people and do things for other people, or whether you basically just descend into an increasingly kind of bitter and dried up person, basically.
So
I find it fascinating that, you know, once you're on these routes, you say there's that sense of gratitude as well to the creator or God or whatever you want to call that energy. That it's like nothing else when you really feel as if you've been protected and you think,
yeah,
you know, that really could have been it there.
Yeah.
I mean, I certainly had the experience when I thought they were trying to kill me. And this is before I was even spiritual, in fact. But I had the experience where I had that total present thing where the back tire had gone out and the car was going off the road. And suddenly at that point in your life, your whole past is meaningless. There's no future. All there is that moment where you've got to make sure the car does certain things, like not hit the central barrier, but doesn't hit any cars on the carriageway, whatever, you know. And it's just that moment.
Yeah.
But to me now, looking back at the time, I think, God, that's really lucky. But I look back on that now as a spiritual person. It was almost like a beam took hold of that car and stopped it from going to the central reservation. And almost seemed to open up a gap in the traffic so I could very easily get the car back over to the hard shoulder as well.
Yeah.
And at the time, I thought it was just a complete coincidence. But looking back on that, that to me was obviously someone was looking after me in that moment. And I'd say I've now been in 3 car accidents. And I'm starting to look way beyond coincidence. And
yeah,
of course, car accidents are used precisely because they are so common. And I say that's how I've got through those things. There's been some kind of guardian angel or something watching over me that's made sure that I am here now to do what I've got to do, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, then, as I said, you know, very soon after that, I think I organised my first rally because, became a protester after that. And that was the scariest one, just on Instow Beach, our local beach. And never forget the bit of a football team in their spanking red tracksuits, you know, on the way to a home game. And bless them, they all came over and listened. And we got Peter Kindersley down to speak, which is like a huge honour at the time, because he was the one who actually took MAF to court on the issue of vaccination compared to slaughter. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, there was like easy enough vaccines to sort of like just basically vaccinate all the cattle that needed 50p a vaccine. And they were paying like farmers £1,000 compensation and saying this is like the way to deal with this wretched, you know, this wretched disease and everything like that. It was, of course, it was all complete nonsense, as we all know.
But presumably this is part of what was behind this agenda, is to stop small farmers, wasn't it? I mean, it's about...
You know, I really do believe that. Yeah, the areas, you know, I mean, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I mean, the facts speak for itself. I mean, yeah.
We say there's no such thing as conspiracy theory in a sense. Everything's a conspiracy theory because it's people conspiring in secret against us. And obviously, if you're going to carry out a program like that, you need a conspiracy of people to do it, basically. So I don't think any of us are conspiracy theorists about this. There's probably good evidence for this as well, I'd imagine. And I've got to say, I mean, I worked on, in my days before working... before I went on the run, between MI5 and going on the run, I worked on the slaughter of the BSE cattle, basically, when I was a management consultant.
Right.
And that was a similar kind of thing. It was about concentrating the slaughterhouse industry in a few select hands and making it very difficult for small farmers to exist. You know, they'd compensate the cattle, but there would be no idea that they'd actually carry on farming.
Yeah.
So all that their kind of stuff would then be taken up by big business, basically. And again, I think that was strategic. And the waste of money involved with these civil servants, letting these contracts for people... something I'd never heard of, the Intervention Board. I mean, I was actually going to write a book called Mad Cows and Englishmen, basically, because of the amount of money these people were wasting. I was also thought of myself as kind of the Heinrich Himmler of the cow world as well. I was the architect of the final solution for millions of cows that had to be slaughtered and incinerated and disposed of as quickly as possible. I certainly think, so I know what you're saying from that. I mean, if you talk a bit more about that, because I mean, I, you know, all of these things, I think there's a serious, much more dark reason behind them as ever given as the ostensible reason. And I mean, and I also think some of the dark reason behind these things is to do with blood sacrifice, to be absolutely blunt. That this mass slaughter of cattle, and I mean, somebody once told me as well that they were slaughtering some of the foot and mouth cattle on junctions of ley lines as well. To get the full kind of dark energy from it. I don't know if you know anything about that.
No, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know about that. All I know is that it was a blanket slaughter attempt in the whole whole of Devon.
Tell us a bit more about your experience with that. Because you're saying you did all the reading about EU law. And again, this resonates with me so much because I had to do the same thing in my own court case. If you want to get things done, don't trust lawyers, don't trust accountants, don't trust anybody else. Do your own reading, know your own information.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we live this stuff. I mean, for lawyers, it's a job.
Yeah,
you know, they might care for their clients to a certain extent. I don't know, but at the end of the day, they're going to another job. For us, it's our lives, basically. And at the end of the day, I don't think you can trust lawyers. like I don't think he does anybody else. I think you want to get anything done, you've got to do it yourself. And you've got to do your reading. You've got to know your facts. So you've got them at the fingertips whenever you're doing anything, basically.